This programme was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Bringing Wellbeing to Life, the programme that takes wellbeing research off the page and into our lives. I'm Dr. Denise Quinlan, and today we're talking about what schools can do to support the wellbeing of their students. In particular, what they can do to make it easier for children and young adults to develop secure relationships and develop a secure sense of attachment and belonging in their school. My guest today is Nathan Wallace, long-term child advocate, advocating for the importance of attachment and secure relationships from early childhood onwards. Nathan really encourages school practices that are aligned with and supportive of the developmental stages that children are going through. He's a neuroscience educator, translating and sharing findings from neuroscience with parents, teachers, and those in places like the Ministry of Education and other administrations that have influence. Best of all, he's really clear on what we can do to help our tamariki and the rangatahi enjoy wellbeing. Kia ora, Nathan, and welcome to Bringing Wellbeing to Life.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Delighted to have you here. So, Nathan, you've worked for a long time now translating neuroscience and other child development findings into really doable practical strategies that parents and schools can use. Tell us about this mission of yours and what kind of got you fired up on it.
Well, I think probably it relates back to my very first experience as a primary school teacher. I went straight from high school, trained as a primary school teacher. One of my first experiences in the classroom was having all these kids from Cambodia that were, some of them had seen their parents killed, so they'd stepping over dead bodies. So my first experience as a teacher was scared kids don't do a lot of learning. You know, I knew nothing about neuroscience or social emotional well-being or anything really. You just work out that those kids' minds are not focused on learning, so you need to do things to make them feel safe and make them feel looked after. I needed to act more like a nurturer and a dad, and then I could act like a teacher. But you couldn't go straight to acting like a teacher. So I just realised the huge significance of social emotional well-being, that we've tended to think that it's your IQ and how intelligent you are, but I realise that varies hugely according to how safe you feel and how well looked after you are. So I went back to university, did more training, and to train as a child therapist. So I suppose in some ways that's what got me started. I mean, in lots of ways, I was also the family babysitter, so I remember, having the babies rammed at me from the time I was four saying, oh, Nathan's good with babies, I stopped crying with Nathan. So it's hard to say when it started, really.
But it sounds like a lifelong interest and commitment to what works to make young people feel safe and able to really engage and learn and be happy.
Just maximise their potential. I mean, everyone's really special, aren't they? It's not just a sort of a glib thing to say. Everybody is special. There is real specialness in every person, so we should be really aiming to find that.
Rather than pushing square pegs into round holes everywhere.
Yeah, or just this conformist thing, or just thinking that it's skill-based.
So this brings us on to, so what would be your key messages to parents and teachers of preschoolers and new entrants about what they can do?
I think the key message would have to be the three R's are the most important. And the three R's are relationship, relationship, and relationship. It's not about so much reading, writing, and arithmetic, and that's sort of something we associate with the frontal cortex, which is around 7. I mean, it's obviously, as soon as the child says a word, they're using their frontal cortex, but that doesn't move into centre stage development until around 7. Yeah. Anyone that's gone to teachers' college knows about Piaget's stages of cognitive development, and you reach that stage at 7 to 8 when you really formalise learning. So under that age, what I'd like them to know is it's about a million things that develop in the child's brain, but they're all centred on this one-on-one relationship. You know, over and over again, we see in the research, and that's what I'm really strong about, it's like implementing the research. Like, and it's kind of undisputed in the research that the number one factor that determines a kid's outcomes from a classroom is the quality of the relationship with the teacher, beyond the parents' qualifications or the relationships with peers or it's that. So I suppose the message I want everyone to understand is the more you can invest in a one-on-one, high-quality relationship, the better all the outcomes will be for the rest of their life.
And that goes for whether you're a parent or a preschool teacher or a new entrant teacher.
Yep, it does. It just means fostering that intimacy and that partnership. I mean, it's the difference between having a being raised evolutionary-wise, it's the difference between having four aunties or having three aunties. What's the difference that you're getting from that extra relationship? Because aunties are already nurturing. They already look after your needs. They already feed you when you're hungry. So what is it you're getting extra? And it's that intimacy and that partnership that really facilitates all of the most finely and highly evolved parts of our brain.
And I was thinking of you earlier. I was reading something, and there's this lovely heading to a chapter on relationships, and it's a quote from a guy called Gary Smalley, and it says, "Life is relationship. The rest is just details."
Love it. That's perfect.
I thought you'd enjoy that.
Yeah, that sums it up wonderfully.
So really, for parents, it's very much around what can they do to have that one-on-one time. And are there any changes that you'd encourage schools to think about, primary schools in particular, to support optimal child development, well-being and learning?
Yes, there is one that I really try and ram home, which it doesn't fit very well with our cultural base. I don't think it's that well received, but it's absolutely backed up by the research. If I could change one thing, it would be stop changing the teacher all of the time. And get rid of the idea of having a new entrance teacher and then a year one teacher and then a year two teacher. Because I think a lot of children in their primary school experience having had six or seven superficial relationships and not one deep meaningful one. And your brain needs that deep meaningful one. And I think it's just too glib to say all the teachers should have wonderful, meaningful relationships with all 30 kids when you've got them for 10 months. This is not the reality of how relationships work. You can do that sometimes. You know, if you get a class of 30 kids, there's probably 10 of them that you click with instantly. It doesn't require a lot of skill because your temperament bases match up. But they're the easy ones for you to teach. And then there's probably another 10 that doesn't click instantly. And you use your professional skills and your relationship building skills and that whole kitty of skills that you've built up as a teacher. And a parent and an auntie and all of that stuff, and you work a wee bit harder, and it takes longer to build those relationships. But then there's another 10 in the class that, your temperament might clash with them. Some of those 10 are going to come from a traumatic background, and they have put on so many layers to protect themselves from it that it's going to take you more than a year to get through that. So I think I just know from a brain point of view that the brain, if we want that frontal cortex to develop, then the first thing that the brain needs is a dyadic relationship. Most of us get it from mum, when we're a newborn. When you said about your close relationship with your aunties, I had grandmothers that were particularly close and much more involved. It doesn't matter the biology or the relation of that person, as long as you have that one-on-one relationship, that intimacy with someone, it triggers, gives your brain what it needs, and allows you to grow that frontal cortex, which is empathy, controlling emotions, seeing things from other people's point of view. So I just think that if we used to get more of that, like it used to be that you went to early childhood and you had the same teacher for when you were 3 and 4, 2, 3 and 4. Now they tend to want to copy the primary schools to lift their status in New Zealand. And so you've got the 2-year-old room and the 3-year-old room and the 4-year-old room. So now they're no longer receiving that dyadic relationship their brain needs at early childhood. They didn't receive it. And then they're going to a primary school where they're going to have a new entrance teacher. And that's going to be year 1 and year 2. I can just see... I mean, you probably are aware, Denise, and a lot of people are aware of it, that we, and Celia Lashley lost her job, talking about it actually, saying we know who the prison population is going to be when you're 25. We can tell you who they are now as 3-year-olds. So she didn't get fired because she was wrong. She got fired because you're not allowed to say that when, when you work for the ministry. She's absolutely right. That really disturbs me that we know who's going to be in prison when they're 25. Not with 100% accuracy, with a really high degree of accuracy. We know who that cohort's going to be. And from my perspective around brain development, the single thing that could have saved them was a dyadic relationship. That would give their brainstem what it needs to calm, which allows their frontal cortex to develop, which allows controlling emotion, empathy, higher intelligence, focusing attention, all the things that will allow them to be successful and keep them out of jail. But they don't even get to access that part of the brain because no one's giving them a dyad. They've either come from foster care, and we have an atrocious system of foster care in New Zealand that is, I'm just going to say it, it's institutional abuse. There is no way that you can go in the foster care system as an infant under 3 and not be abused. I think in terms of, we've got a system that says your relationship will be changed multiple times. You don't go straight to a carer. We remove your baby. You don't go straight to the carer and stay there. You go to another carer temporarily in between and might stay there for 6 months to start to form an attachment, and then you'll move to the next person. To me, that's institutional abuse. So they've come from that background, or they've come from a postnatally depressed mother. For whatever reason, that percentage of kids that did not receive a dyad, and now they're going to early childhood centres and not receiving it, because they've got the 3-year-old room and the 4-year-old room, and then they're going to the primary school. I just wish that they would change that. I think I fluked it. I come from a not very desirable background, but I went to a country school. So you had to get a dyadic relationship because it was only the little room and the big room.
So you were there for a while.
Yeah, you're there for all the primary school. So you had that teacher and that teacher. Even an average teacher fulfills a dyad when you have that teacher for 3 years. years, they become like an uncle, the relationship or an auntie. The relationship becomes more, I mean, a real uncle or an auntie. The relationship becomes more nuanced. It becomes a high-quality relationship because it's got history, it's got shared experience, whereas it's hard to build that up in 1 year, 15 months.
Mm. And presumably in a small community as well, you're amplifying the shared experience of a small community, that you know what's been going on for local events, people's families, all that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So Nathan, how about, we know there are systems that do it differently. So for example, Steiner, you have the same teacher for about 7 years. Any data on how that works?
Yeah, there are aspects of Steiner which excite me, like having the same teacher for 7 years. And we've got correlative data that shows that that's really good. You know, we need a mainstream environment where there's a control group that continues to be mainstream, and then the rest of them, the other kids have the same teacher for 7 years to really isolate that one factor. In a Steiner school, that's going on, but there's whole multiple other factors going on too. So you just get correlative outcomes. But yeah, there are aspects of Steiner that I really, really like. You know, I can't, I don't know it well enough to endorse the whole thing, but I certainly no character books. I'm keeping the same teacher. I absolutely love. I love how when I've been into Steiner schools, they send you your body from there. That really resonates for someone who understands neuroscience as well, that you engage the whole body in the learning process. I saw kids getting down and making the shape three with their body while they're learning about three. And I just thought, oh, that's really clever. That's really helpful.
This is what three feels like at a whole body level. Yeah.
It's a whole bringing in so much more of the system, the central nervous system.
Nice. So Nathan, you're also really very well known for your work on educating parents and teachers about the teenage brain. Tell us about the key messages that you want to give to parents and teachers about teenagers and their brains.
Okay, you get quite different parents coming along with the teenage brain. I always laugh because when they come for the first 1,000 days, they're all looking bright and full of hope. And when they come along to the teenage brain, there's a few more weary faces. I think you hit that point, and I know I hit it, where your teenagers hit that middle of adolescence, and you hit that point where you go, oh no, I think I may have done the whole thing horribly wrong. I think I may have parented really badly because look what's happened.
It's like, oh, bring on the fast food. I've ruined everything else.
Yeah. But I think the message for parents is to understand that adolescence is a real thing happening inside the brain. It's not just made up. It's not caused by Facebook. It's not caused, it wasn't caused by video games. I mean, my grandmother was convinced that adolescence was caused by Elvis pelvis. You know, every generation tends to blame whatever is the newest technology. But brain-wise, it's to do with the fact that your frontal cortex, brain number 4, the last one to develop, the one that controls your emotions, sees things from other people's point of view, understands consequences. That brain, for around about 3 years, somewhere in the middle between 7 and 27, is going to basically shut for renovations, and that's called adolescence. So yes, your teenager is supposed to go backwards in empathy. They're supposed to go backwards in controlling their emotions. You know, rates of anxiety, depression and stuff soar during adolescence. Because the part of the brain that controls emotions, that sees things from other people's point of view, that understands consequences, is for 90% of the day going to be shut for renovations. So you will get this flash coming through of your teenager's frontal cortex. They have moments where they're wonderfully articulate. They have moments where they basically are an adult. Becoming an adult and being a teenager, your frontal cortex doesn't have to get better. It has to move from being only online 10% of the time to being online 90% of the time. But in that 10% of the time when it's on, your teenager's just as good at empathy as you are, just as good at understanding the future or understanding consequences. Like I say, 10% of the time they are an adult. But 90% of the time it's going to be shut down, shut for renovations. And that's going to force them back down into brain number 3, which is their emotional brain. So they become, not only can they not control their emotions because the frontal cortex is shut down, but now it's like the emotions have to turbocharge as well because they're living in that place. So emotions soar. Teenagers are not famous for their logic. Anyone that's had a 16-year-old daughter in love can see that that's not, or a son, actually, that's not, they don't come home and say, oh, I'm in love with him because he's got good money earning potential. He's got a good relationship with his mother, so I think that means he respects women. He's got his past partners talk about him as being a really good guy. They don't come home, 40-year-old woman on Tinder and look for that, because that's, you've got a frontal cortex and you want those characteristics. Those things matter. But 15-year-olds come home with no logic. It's like, oh, I love him. He's the school drug dealer and he's been expelled and he beat up his last girlfriend, but I love him. It's emotion.
He's lovely.
Yeah, I think it's for parents to understand there's nothing gone wrong with your teenager. They're supposed to be very emotional. It's just something that we really need to nurture and support them through. I think when they were two, you had to kind of be their frontal cortex for them. They could do bugger all, but they couldn't calm themselves down. You had to rock them. They couldn't go to bed by themselves. You had to take them and read them a story. You kind of were their frontal cortex at two in many ways. And then from two to like 15, you've been handing over the roles, the responsibilities of the cortex. I think the best advice is just realizing that you've got to take back a lot of that responsibility when you're a teenager. I'd really like people not to try and fight their teenager into being well-behaved. I'd like them to understand that stuff and then nurture their teenager into being well-behaved.
And what are some of the strategies that you'd recommend to parents or teachers for engaging well with their teenager during that adolescent phase when they're not so logical and maybe a bit more prone to...
My advice would be chill out and shut up, because that's what most of us don't do. You're not shaping their character and their work values during adolescence. That was done well before. You had the first 3 years to build their brain. You had until 11 to shape their character, and now you've just got to live with them. So stop creating fights where you think you're trying to build character and stuff, because that happened beforehand. I would even go so far as to say, actually, just allow them a little bit to be a bit of a sullen, lazy teenager. It doesn't mean they're going to be sullen and lazy for the rest of their life. Just like teenagers don't get out of bed till 4, you still don't have any problem going to work when you're an adult. All of that stuff set beforehand. So I think it is
maybe one of the pieces of advice I'd add for parents of children and teenagers in that phase is go and talk to people whose kids have come out of it. And remind yourself that it ends.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And understand that it's mainly about that emotional bond. So if you don't listen to your emotional bond, then you're part of the 90% of parents that teenagers say don't listen to. And you think you're listening to them because you're listening for some logic, but their world's not logic. Our world's logic. Their world is emotion. So if you don't speak to that emotional brain, then you've ignored your child. And children will do as you do, not as you say. Mm-hmm. So if you're ignoring your kids, expect your kids to ignore you. Speaking to that emotional brain just means speak to their emotion first. You know that example I said.
So first of all, listen to the emotions and then respond to the emotions you're hearing. Yeah,
I think we do listen to them. We listen to them inside our head as parents, and we remember being 16. We remember being heartbroken, but we don't voice it. So the kids don't know we've listened. So I think that's the important. I mean, I don't mean that you bring out all your own experience of being 16, because then it's like it's not about you. but. Just acknowledge, so instead of just having it in your head, when the 16-year-old goes, I'm devastated, I don't want to go back to school, I'm devastated because I've broken up with my partner and I'm never going to fall in love with anybody ever again, and what's the point of going on because that was my one person I could ever be in love with. I'm just describing myself at 16, because my mother had to deal with that. but when you're doing that at 16, you think the world's over. If you go straight to logic with that child, like my mum, trying to be helpful, said, oh, it's just puppy love, Nathan. You'll be fine in a couple of weeks. Well, that did not make me feel better. That made me just think, this is the most important thing that's ever happened in my life, and my mother's equating it to puppies. She's clearly too old to remember what it feels like to fall in love. So I'm saying do the opposite to that. She went straight to logic, and like a helpful mum was trying to fix my problem and help me, and she wanted her boy to feel better, so she went to problem solving. Even as husbands, we get in trouble for doing that, right? What we need to do is validate the emotion first. The key word's validation. So the 16-year-old says, oh, I'm never going to fall in love again. You can say something like, oh, honey, I know you felt really strongly about Billy. I know, you know, you felt more strong about him than you have about anyone you've ever gone out with, so you must be really devastated. It's not agreeing. I'm not agreeing that she's never going to fall in love again. It's validating. And so what happens is the child goes, oh, he's listening to me. He hears me. He hears my experience. If you have a child that thinks they're being listened to, you're 99% way to have a child that can listen to you. Because that's what you're feeling listens to, so they will do as you do.
And if we think about teenagers and that adolescent period at school, what are some of the things high schools could do to really support them through that stage and support healthy child development?
I have to say, I think that in New Zealand, that's quite difficult for high schools to do, because we have an education system that's very focused on preparing them for the workforce. And so you're more liable to come out of high school with a unit for driving a forklift than you are for having any emotional intelligence. It's not something that's strongly put across in the curriculum, because we're so, I think, run by the business roundtable and stuff, and have our high school's all about getting a job, getting credits. So, for teachers then, within that system, you've got to focus on the pastoral care, which is in the New Zealand culture has sort of been a 10% thing to do on the edge that kind of is annoying and want to get on with getting ready for their NCEA credits. But what I would say is the more you focus on their pastoral care, the more NCEA credits you can get, because it's just how the brain works. So again, schools, even high schools, fostering that dyadic relationship. If you've come from that background of foster care and then gone to the 2-year-old room, the 3-year-old room, and then they, you know, primary school change your teacher every year, now you're going to get to high school and change your teacher every hour. So the naughty kids, and we already know who they are, because you can just ask the primary school. And the primary school didn't know who they are, because they could just ask their early childhood centre. We go back to that senior national principal. We know who they are from when they were 3. So those kids especially need to have an anchored relationship. What I would do is I'd do it for all kids, because I think what's good for traumatised kids is good for all children. Just in the same way that's what's good for Māori, it's actually good for everybody. It's the same principle.
You know, the interesting thing, Nathan, is that all of this completely aligns with what is good for well-being.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It's just that we tend to not look at the well-being until we've got someone in crisis and they might be suicidal, so now we'll look at well-being. You're absolutely right. If we were just blanket general policies of well-being, then you would have it that you come to the high school and you're anchored into one relationship. And it could be that you have the saying, I mean, you see some high schools doing it, going, oh, okay, now you've always been a year 9 dean. But next year, you're going to be the year 10 dean, the year after the year 11 dean. Now the dean's becoming that dyadic one-on-one relationship following them through. But if 100 kids come into year 9, that's not much of a one-on-one. Yeah. Schools that are going a step further go, well, that's not enough. Let's make it a form teacher or a homeroom teacher. And you're going to have the same homeroom teacher from when you started until when you finished high school. So you do have one long-term in-depth relationship. But then again, if you're only with the homeroom teacher for 15 minutes a day, that's not going to be enough to build a relationship for these really traumatised kids. So the schools are going a step further and going, well, okay, for these kids, as well as making sure that Miss Hudson is their form teacher, we're going to make sure Miss Hudson is also their maths teacher and their geography teacher. So now that kid is spending 2 hours and form time with Miss Hudson, and we're going to do that again next year. And that child will develop a high-quality relationship with Miss Hudson, and I think that's what we need to do. That's what's going to save these kids from going to jail.
That's really nice, because it's a lovely way of having, you know, that pyramid of care, that everybody's getting continuity of care through the high school, but then we can pick to add to make that stronger for those who most need.
And I think another big thing that comes through in the research about how well kids do from secondary school is the connection between home and school. We always see that in education. When there's a real divide between the two, kid doesn't tend to do well. When there's a connection, and I think this would fix that as well, because there'd be one person that the parents get to know and to liaise with all the way through secondary school. My experience with secondary school is pretty universal with other parents that I hear, is we're involved in year 9, because those teachers are normally a bit nicer, often a primary school teacher. And a bit more relationship focus, but then you lose them after that year and you're in a sea of other relationships and you're disengaged for the rest of the kids' high school. I think, I'm a teacher and I work in education and I'm involved in it.
Yeah.
And I really had bugger all to do with my kids' secondary school education, because unless you actively throw yourself into the board of trustees,
we have to have a little shout out to say, I have my son's physics teacher, who is his teacher in year 9, was somebody whom I connected with because my son cared about him and spoke about him so much. In year 10, the thing my son was looking forward to in year 12 was that he'd have this teacher again.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
And when I spoke to him about, I said, so, you know, talking to him about his teaching, and he said, I don't know, I just try and really love them all.
Right, yeah, it's not hard, is it? That reminds me of a documentary I saw about teachers in Finland and trying to look at why Finland gets such better results than everybody else. And they showed all these other countries and they asked all the same question to all the teachers in the different countries. What is the single most important thing you've got to get out of your education? And you've got this vast array of answers from all these other countries, and England and New Zealand tend to be very focused on getting ready for work. And then, like, every single teacher in Finland said, for the child to be happy. And it's like, it's not actually rocket science sometimes, it's just where is your focus.
Speaking of overseas, I know that you have been doing work in China, advising them there on stuff relating to child development. Tell us a bit more about what you've been doing.
I think it's really incredibly innovative of China. I mean, they're real shakers and movers. What I'm doing is going over there to teach early childhood teachers and sort of new entrance primary school teachers the value of play-based learning. Now, in China, I don't have to spearhead that because the government's already spearheaded it. They're aware of all the international research, the same as we are. You know, everyone's got Google. They can even get it in China. So yeah. They're aware of the international research. They know the same stuff that we do around how the advantages of play-based learning and the advantages that leads to resilient teenagers. So the more play-based or creativity you have under seven, the less anxiety, depression, negative outcomes as teenagers. They're aware of all of that. But with the story they put it across to me, which is a simplified one, because I haven't spoken to the Chinese government, obviously. I'm through an early childhood agency within China that's mandated by the government. But the short version is they've worked out that in the last three generations, China has become famous for copying other people's technology, not so much famous for creativity and innovation. That's really dropped in the last three generations. Now, there's clearly no shortage of it in the gene pool because, you know, China for 6,000 years has this history of, you know.
Led the way in creativity.
Yeah, you trace things back to their origin, and it seems like most things are invented in China. So no shortage of it, and then it just leaves three generations. And why was that? Well, because that's when they stopped the kids from playing and sat them down and started getting them ready for school and created this culture of getting 2 and 3 year olds doing literacy and numeracy. So bringing your frontal cortex online early. And so now they've understood that that's why they compare themselves to America. So they basically see that the Chinese kids are doing way better at the exams all the way through our labor. Students' exams, certainly at secondary students' exams, and then they die when they get to university. Because once you need to do more than just get ready for exams and you need to apply it to real life, well, then the people who have played are able to do that. The people that have only got ready for tests can only do tests. You know, there is no creativity, no innovation, no ability to think outside the box, which really means you've got no leadership. There's a fear of any sort of risk-taking. It's hard to be a leader if you've got a fear of any sort of risk-taking. They realise that, and their own experts have told them it's because of what you're doing from the ages of 2 to 7, where you're instituting early cognitive attainment rather than building resilience and fixing social-emotional well-being, and you know, focusing on social-emotional well-being, which builds creativity. Creativity from 2 to 7 is what leads to innovative thinking. So they changed the law in China. It's supposed to be play-based under 7. They can do that relatively easily. They've set up model centres in every city to show people what it looks like.
What it should look like.
What it should look like. So lots of teachers come to and tour that, and I've been through and toured them. But then they also know it could take multiple generations to actually change the culture. So they've got me to go along. They went out and looked around internationally and decided that I was the best person in that they were saying it the clearest, because everyone's got the research. Well, who's saying it the clearest for Chinese teachers to be able to understand? I decided that was me. And so they've got me for 5 years ago. So they want me to do every early childhood teacher in China. So that means every city, you won't get the rural areas, obviously, but every city in China. And so that takes 5 years. We do like 2 cities a time, and we go about 4 times a year.
Wow. And in terms of cultural responsiveness for working in China, what are some of the changes that you might have to think about? Or does it change?
Yeah, for me, working in China, being culturally responsive, I think it's recognising that everyone's on a spectrum. And if you tell those people to completely let go of control and give the kids free play, they wouldn't be ready for that. They would think free play is free range. I mean, a lot of New Zealand parents, they think free play is, just leave the kids at home, leave them in the backyard, do as you want, whereas that's free range. I mean, actually, if they're just being left by themselves, that's neglect. But, you know, free play is requires, you know, it's your art, part of teaching. I was a primary school teacher first and then an early childhood teacher, so I personally found play-based teaching more cognitively difficult for me to master. I had to be more attuned, more observant, more ready to, you know, react to the moment. As a primary school teacher, I can just plan my lesson beforehand and go, this is the beginning, this is the middle, these are the conclusions, mm-hmm. and this is what the children would have produced. But in play-based, as soon as I take charge, I'm outside the body of research that gets to the benefits. So I have to learn to engage with the children in a way that extends them cognitively and enhances their play without ever taking over, not even suggestively making a little suggestion to take over. That's still adult-led. It's got to be 100% child-led, and yet I've got to make that play more complex. So that's quite difficult.
So presumably then for China, then we're talking about teachers who, on one hand, there's a culture change for the teaching people to to let go of control. But then on the other side, there's also a huge professional development piece of learning how to do play-based.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just let go. It's, and here are all the new tools and skills you need.
Yes, that's so much the case, because people let go and then don't know what to do instead.
I'll go and have a cup of tea.
Yeah, that's right.
Not quite, no.
It is half the trouble. And I see lots of schools that are understanding this literature, and they're going, oh, we better be play-based then. And, but there's a real lack of understanding about what that play-based is. I've had a couple of schools say, oh, well, can you come along and do us a two-hour talk and tell us what play-based is? And of course, you know, 2 hours, you can introduce the field of literature. I can give an example. But you can't really sort of summarise 3 years of teacher scholarship into...
It's kind of really just, I'll give you a taster, and if you actually want to do this, you need to engage and learn.
Yeah, and you need to develop. And development is an ongoing process. It's going to be having lots. And it's so much about trusting children too. If you've started out like I did as a primary teacher, you're inherently taught that you need to take responsibility for the child's learning and make sure that they get to hear, and make sure they get to hear, and make sure they get to hear. Whereas play-based is like the exact opposite. It's trust. It's trusting that child's brain is intimately tuned to what they need to do. So when that kid wants to kick a soccer ball against the wall, and he's been doing that for about 1 to 5 weeks from kicking a soccer ball against the wall every time he has free time, then is that really engaged? That is. It's about working with that, you know, getting alongside that. But you still need to start with that. You can't say, no, that's clearly a waste of time.
It's time to do something else.
Yeah. It's trust. And then working with whatever the kid contributes. I mean, usually they contribute way more than that. But even if all they're contributing is kicking a soccer ball against a wall repeatedly, start with that, because that's the communication from the child telling you that's, you know, where they're at, and that's what they need right now. It's trust.
Nice. I like that. Trust the child's brain and body and their development, and be with them.
And trust your own ability to know how to meet that. Because it isn't just trusting one, or else it could just be neglect again. It's trusting and then meeting that with the school base. Mm-hmm. Trust in the school base.
Trust in the unfolding.
Yeah. Trust and respond.
Mm. Mm. And so, Nathan, in terms of how things are developing in the fields of neuroscience and child development, what do you think are the big lessons from those fields for educators, for schools?
Yeah, I suppose that were the big lesson, as I said, relationships. I suppose for schools, it's about realising that we are not getting more robotic as human beings, and we're not just a frontal cortex, but that the human brain's made up of 4 different brains. You've got a survival brain, and on top of that is a movement brain, and on top of that is an emotional brain, and then on top of that is the thinking and learning brain. I think for too long, school, we thought, oh, well, the dog's got the bottom three. Let's just focus on the one the dog hasn't got. And we've been a bit detached and looking at the frontal cortex and units and skills. And I think neuroscience has taught us that it's a complex system and all those brains working together. And the really competent teacher, whether they're doing it consciously or not, is actually engaging all 4 of those brains. Mm-hmm. I think that's what Miss Honey's doing. You know, when you look back over your schooling, you go, I asked you to choose the teacher that was really the most significant. And, you know, even if they weren't conscious of those 4 brains, we could look at their practice and go, yeah, they did. The survival brain, it had his needs met and was calm. Movement brain wasn't restricted in any way, so it was unencumbered. Okay, so that leaves the energy to move up to brain number 3. We get engaged in our learning, and then we've sort of met the needs of all brains 1, 2, and 3. You know, Miss Honey does that sort of just in her nature. But that's why I think the kids get a whole higher grade in Miss Honey's class. Your IQ goes way up in Miss Honey's class.
Because somebody's making us feel safe, attending to our needs, validating our emotions.
Yep.
And engaging us.
Yeah, and that from since the beginning of evolutionary time, that's when you learn. You don't learn when a saber-toothed tiger's chasing you, and you're a bit petrified, or you're self-doubting, and that's a whole different part of the brain that's engaged. So if you feel scared and full of self-doubt in your maths class, of course you're not going to be able to do maths. So it would be like asking the dog to do maths, because you're just in the wrong brain. But yeah, if you feel like your maths teacher is, you've got to be safe with them, they respect you, and they've made it interesting and they've connected it to your world, and then you're engaged with that, then I imagine you'll be an amazing mathematician. And you could have started out with exactly the same genetic potential for maths.
And presumably then also this kind of applies at the collective scale as well as the individual scale, that in terms of our whole school environment, we need to feel safe and validated as we're walking around the corridors, on the playing fields, engaging with any of the staff?
Well, I think you need to feel safe as well. It might be a bridge too far to think that they're going to be these little havens. I mean, teenagers are horrible when they want to be. Other children bully, and their frontal cortex is shut down, and they lack empathy, and they can be cruel. I don't think that we need to stop them being teenagers. I've done that since the beginning of time. You just put adults around them and systems around there to mitigate them, and you make sure that as well as putting up with the adolescent bullying and stuff that children put up with, they are also receiving high-quality, reciprocal relationships where they are trusted. And you know, so it's about getting both, I think. It might be idealistic to think that you're always going to be safe, but you need to know how to get to a safe place.
Nice. Thank you. And Nathan, if you could only do one thing for the rest of your life to support well-being in the world at large, what would it be?
I would wave a magic wand and get everyone to love themselves, in the same way that they love their best friend. Because then, if you treated yourself like the same way that you treat your best friend, then the stuff would disappear. It really is self-love. Self-love is about that voice in your head. I think so much of the theorists that I get exposed to, you know, across my whole career, about the unifying message underneath, it's about taking control of that voice inside your head. That voice inside your head is not supposed to be abusive to you. And so now that you're an adult, don't let that be abusive. Just simply don't allow it. Just busy yourself with something else. Quickly ring someone. Starve that voice to death if it is being horrible to you, because it's not in that. It's not supposed to be a critical parent. It's supposed to be your best friend.
A loving friend.
Yeah, if you starve that uncritical parent, then you will find there is a friend that will come forward. And your inner voice is starting to say to you, you can so do this. You've met other challenges before and you've risen to those. And if you really, the same stuff you say to your best friend, why would you ever say to your best friend, you can't wear that, you're too fat. You can't do that. Like, only really clever people do that. And you're like, you know, but stupid, aren't you? But people talk to themselves like that and they're here all the time. But yeah, I think that's the trick. That would be my one thing.
Oh, nice. And last question, Nathan. What's your own go-to strategy for boosting your own well-being whenever you feel like really frustrated or down? What works for you?
I put my power song on.
You know, what's your power song?
Oh, it's embarrassing.
I'll tell you mine if you tell yours.
Well, I just want to put a pre-claimer that I didn't like choose my song. It chose me. It's just a song that I end up that, and it's kind of over the top and silly, and that's what makes me just realise life's silly and just buck up your confidence. It's I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. But it's hard to keep serious and keep life really serious.
Yeah, because you immediately start strutting.
Yeah, I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt, yeah.
Oh, excellent. Mine is Ronan Keating and Loving Each Day. It was my husband's fault, actually. He made me play it one day when I was going to do something really scary. And now I put it on and you have to do this massive woo shriek at the start.
Okay, right. Cool.
It helps.
Sometimes, yeah. And it's the music, not the words. I've never, other than I'm Too Sexy for My Shirt, I don't even know what the other words are.
It's just loud music.
That particular riff. That particular style of music that lifts my emotions. I think, find what that is. We underuse music, don't we? Because music has the power to change your emotions. But festival.
Gorgeous. Nathan, thank you so much for talking to us today. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I know our listeners will really enjoy hearing you too.
Great. Thank you, Denise. Thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Bringing Wellbeing to Life on ORFM Dunedin. If you'd like to learn more, our book, The Educator's Guide to Whole School Wellbeing, is available from nziwr.co.nz from early 2020. You can also listen to a podcast of this show on oar.org.nz, on nziwr.co.nz, and you can also subscribe to Apple Podcasts. I'm Dr. Denise Quinlan. Thank you for listening. This program has been brought to you by the New Zealand Institute of Wellbeing and Resilience. For more information on how schools, communities and workplaces can grow their wellbeing and resilience, go to nziwr.co.nz.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.